I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A critic of President Bush says the president has scored many malignant achievements. What does Andrew Bacevich mean? We'll get to that. But first, John McCain supporter Senator Lindsey Graham reacted today to General Wesley Clark's statement that McCain's service in Vietnam does not qualify him for president.
General Clark has made a huge mistake here. No matter how he sugarcoats it, he's trying to question John's service.
Clark says he stands by his comments, unlike Senator Jay Rockefeller, who last April asked why McCain never talked about the civilians killed when he dropped missiles in Vietnam and later apologized profusely. Questions about McCain's character, are they legitimate or part of a new round of political mudslinging that includes allegations spray-painted on cars in Florida that Barack Obama smokes crack? Ben Smith of Politico.com is here. Ben, many Democrats have been incredulous at Clark's remark. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think Clark both believes what he says and believes, contrary to kind of conventional wisdom, that it's worth doing, worth attacking McCain. And he's not attacking the substance of McCain's service. He said on TV last night, I didn't mean to diss John McCain's service.
Well, but he's not the only one. Now, we rush to say there aren't that many voices asking these questions, but you write that a former editor of Mother Jones magazine is calling for John McCain to release his Navy files. He says that, you know, we'll see that John McCain screwed up again and again, only to be forgiven because his father and grandfather were four-star generals. You know, others like Noam Chomsky and America Blog's John Aravosis both say, why can't we ask questions about the relevance of his POW status to his leadership abilities? Is there a sense that somebody's running this up the flagpole to see if this is a good approach?
Well, there are two things going on. I mean, what Wes Clark is saying is kind of some intramilitary politics in part. Then there's something else going on, which is like Aravosis' blog post and a bunch of other stuff kind of rattling around the left, saying, you know, basically that McCain's service was not honorable, saying that he was a fighter pilot and he may have killed civilians, for instance, when he was bombing Hanoi in 67, or saying that he signed a kind of false confession when he was in Vietnam after he was tortured. I mean, most people do not blame John McCain for this, and in fact, he later resisted collaborating and resisted early release.
Well, especially since he's written about that, those people who are questioning even his POW status, some saying that maybe he wasn't even tortured. He was a Manchurian candidate. What's the thinking about that? Because some would say that's political suicide.
The craziest bit stuff, the Manchurian candidate stuff, actually comes from the right. McCain tried to debunk the rumors that there were still POWs in Vietnam, and the people who were leading and profiting from the POW-MIA movement really hate him and have hated it, and he was kind of at war with them in the 90s. He and John Kerry were together, actually. And those people, you know, claimed that he was in league with the Vietnamese, basically. Some of that has sort of been picked up on the left more recently. Ironically, some of the hatred of John Kerry came from that same source. And some of the people on the left are saying, well, you know what, look what the right did to John Kerry, attacking again the details of what was widely seen as his honorable military service, so why should John McCain be immune? Why can't we play this game?
Well, and they also say, we rush to add, that they're not mocking John McCain, they're merely asking questions. Noam Chomsky would say that. But some, I'm sure, listening would say, even bringing up some of these accusations gives them a currency that they don't deserve. But you mentioned John Kerry. He was criticized for not addressing the accusations made by the Swift voters in 2004, thinking, who would believe those? Ben, do you get a sense that this is a burble that's going to go away? And is John McCain going to do something about it?
In this case, I think the Democrats would sincerely like it to go away. They don't want to spend the rest of the summer talking about whether John McCain was honorable in Vietnam, because they think he was. Barack Obama would also prefer not to have to say every day what a great hero John McCain was.
Well, and the attacks on Barack Obama have been going on much longer. The Washington Post ran a fascinating article this week. They went to Ohio, and they visited with a lifelong Democrat who couldn't fight off the rumors he was hearing. He says, for instance, I understand that Barack Obama is from Africa, and the first thing he's going to do if he gets in office is bring his family over here illegally. There's the Muslim thing. Of course, he's, Barack Obama, not a Muslim. This is a guy who's trying to fight off the rumors but can't.
Right. I think it's partly kind of the flip side of Barack Obama's tremendous success on the Internet. It's been these Internet-driven whispers that are incredibly widespread. And, I mean, to some degree, these are people who believed that John Kerry was a communist, believed that Bill Clinton was a Russian spy. I mean, if this country is so partisan and so divided, if there are on both sides people who are going to believe horrible things about the leader of the other party, the question is how much it's penetrating among, swing voters, among people who would consider voting against him, but for that. And the Obama campaign, I think, is very concerned about it and really concerned about what it, a broader perception that he's in some sense not American enough. And so their television advertising campaign, which is really, you know, kind of the central element of how you present your message and your candidate, has really just been hammering into people's heads his roots in Kansas values and his grandparents from Kansas. And that's really sort of been the message they're trying to drive home.
And both candidates have launched truth squads. Barack Obama has the fightthesmears.com website. It seems as if the Swift voters in 2004 have had another effect, which is maybe waking up candidates in 2008.
The lesson the Obama campaign took from you know, the Swift voters and from just sort of the new media environment is that sunlight is the best remedy, is that they want to take all this stuff head on. They're not afraid of repeating rumors, you know, that it would get out there more because they're debunking them, which was the old conventional wisdom. McCain is doing something different here. McCain is, I don't think, actually concerned that people are going to think he's a war criminal. McCain is playing the victim and to get more attention paid to his biography. And also to say, hey, look, I'm a victim of a smear campaign, too, because Obama is being seen as the victim of this horrible smear campaign. And in politics, everybody wants to be the victim.
Ben Smith, who's been following the presidential campaigns, sometimes wearing heavy boots because of the mud that's being slung, for Politico.com. Ben, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There are more tough words today from one of the Bush administration's toughest critics. Andrew Bacevich is professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam, a self-described conservative and critic of the war in Iraq from its inception, whose son, many of you know, was killed serving in Iraq in 2007. His op-ed in today's Boston Globe is What Bush Hath Wrought. Andrew, you list what you call the malignant achievements of the Bush administration. What do you mean by that, malignant?
Two things, really. The first is, a real thrust of the piece is to try to suggest that the tendency to see President Bush as a failed president overlooks some enormous achievements. Now, I think those achievements are quite negative in terms of their implications. But if you look at the Bush record from the point of view of somebody like the president or Cheney or maybe ex-Secretary Rumsfeld, they've done a whole lot. Is that they have persuaded us that the only response to Islamic radicalism is to engage in an open-ended global war. They have persuaded us that preventive war is a doctrine to which the United States should subscribe.
Well, and some would say post-9/11, what is wrong with defining this contemporary era as an age of terror, which is another of your criticisms, or having an open-ended global war because these attacks come, sporadically, and you can't assume that it's over?
And it's not over. The point of the piece is not to suggest that violent Islamic radicalism is not a threat, but the Bush administration has vastly overstated that threat. You say, why not global war? Iraq is an example of why not global war. More broadly, the cost that we have incurred. I mean, just yesterday, the president signed off on another $192 billion. We can't afford that as a country. Global war is a defective idea.
Before we move on to your other larger idea in the piece, which is how does the next president deal with the achievements, you call them the malignant achievements of the Bush administration, how would you suggest that a radical Islamist be dealt with?
One problem is the small number of people engaged in a conspiracy to try to do us harm. We should view them as members of an international criminal conspiracy, and we should launch an international police effort to find them and to remove them.
You know, Andrew Bacevich, people on your own conservative side of the fence, as you've described yourself, find that laughable, that it be a criminal action.
I know that they do. I mean, and I know that the claim is that the events of 9/11 disprove that approach. I don't think that's true. I mean, to say that we might have had criminal action in downtown Boston yesterday, somebody robbing a bank, doesn't prove that. We shouldn't view bank robbers as criminals. And again, I would argue strongly the approach of global war manifestly has failed. And so we need to rethink the basic approach.
Some of your other criticisms that President Bush has enhanced the prerogatives of the imperial presidency. We know he's signed hundreds of signing statements, for instance, overturning a congressional law, that he affirmed that the primary role of the Department of Defense is not defense, but power projection. And your concern is, what does the next president do to shift from what's been put in place here? Tell us more about those concerns.
Well, both Senator McCain and Senator Obama insist that this coming election is going to be a pivotal one. And with regard to national security, it's not going to be a pivotal election if their debate is simply about, well, what are we going to do about Iraq? for the election to play a decisive role, the argument between the two of them has to take into account all that the Bush administration has achieved. Again, I think those achievements are negative. I actually suspect that Senator McCain views most of the achievements in that regard as positive, and he will affirm them. And so the op-ed tries to suggest that it's really incumbent upon Senator Obama to confront those accomplishments and to explain how he's going to undo the Bush legacy.
We've been speaking to analysts about the Bush presidency, Vice President Dick Cheney making no bones about how he wanted to expand the powers of the White House. And to a person, they say that no matter who is the next president, it's going to be very hard for them to give back any of those powers, even if politically they might have been against them going into office.
No president, even if it's Obama, is going to give them back unless they're encouraged to give them back by a Congress that becomes more assertive in insisting that the Congress is going to play its proper role as outlined in the Constitution. In other words, the Congress can't allow presidents to engage in the sort of trickery that's involved in this practice of signing statements, which basically renders legislation inoperative.
If the president so chooses. Well, and then there's the second question, which goes to the broader point in your piece today. You say there's no political traction for either the criticisms or the advice that you are giving to Barack Obama. And there have been a series of scathing reports recently. This week, the Army concluded there was no preparation for post-invasion Iraq. A New York Times series a while back pointed out that retired military brass were part of a White House PR campaign. In June, the Senate Intelligence Committee said that the Bush White House exaggerated claims of WMDs, ignored dissenting voices in the run-up to the war. The Supreme Court just ruled against the Bush administration in the Guantanamo Bay habeas corpus case. Given all of those scathing reports, there's been very little reaction. And so it feels as if that backs up your thinking that there's no political traction for this.
I agree. I'm just continually struck by the extent to which our public discourse about this upcoming election seems to express such expectations that electing A versus B is going to make all the difference in the world. I don't think that's going to be the case unless the debate between A and B takes fully into account all that has occurred since 9/11. And I do believe that it's incumbent in particular on Senator Obama to be the candidate who will acknowledge all that the Bush administration has accomplished, again, looking well beyond Iraq, and be able to explain why that legacy is malignant and why it must be undone and how he will be the president who will actually undo it.
That's Boston University professor and retired Colonel Andrew Bacevich. His forthcoming book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. And Andrew, thanks so much as always.
Thank you very much.
The slow food movement started in Italy 20 years ago. Now it's a worldwide attempt to link health with pleasure and ecology with social justice. Slow food advocates turn away from corporate fast food to return to the pleasures of shared eating. They want regional dishes made with food grown locally and traded at prices that allow farmers a decent living. Slow food founder Carlo Petrini and Erica Lesser of Slow Food USA and Mr. Petrini's translator recently stopped by our studios. Now, it's well known that Carlo began the movement after a McDonald's restaurant opened in Rome, the horror of golden arches in an historic square. The arches, by the way, were banned. But McDonald's is also affordable and, well, fast for working families with kids. So we asked, what would Carlo Petrini say to those who say on a long road trip the arches can seem like a godsend?
Well, behind the golden arches, of course, it's just a huge multinational business. In terms of the content, the substance of what they produce, it is a homogenization of taste.
Il cibo è come linguaggio.
Food is like language, and when you have many kinds of food, that represents, like many languages, biodiversity.
Il linguaggio di McDonald's è un linguaggio solo.
Whereas the language of McDonald's is just one language. But I would hope and prefer to see that we could have a great diversity of foods and of cooking methods rather than just one.
Well, but, you know, that's a lovely idea. But why is it a better idea, you know, for the earth, for, you know, other reasons? Because, again, McDonald's is affordable so for some people. So why is diversity of foods a better idea outside of an aesthetic idea?
Ma ci sono migliaia.
There are thousands of foods around the world that cost little or cost less than McDonald's.
In tutto il Medio Oriente,
in all of the Middle East, there's kebab.
In tutto la Spagna ci sono le tapas.
In Spain, you have tapas.
In tante parti del mondo c'è un cibo.
In so many parts of the world, you have different affordable foods. Why should we only have McDonald's?
Well, and why is it better for the world? I think it's a wonderful idea to have diversity. I want to find kebab when I go to the Middle East and not go to McDonald's. But for someone who's not persuaded, why is it a better idea for sustainability, for all the other issues, to have diversity of foods?
Perché la diversità vuol dire,
because diversity also means creating and supporting local economies, respecting the culture of a local people.
Le tradizioni di un popolo.
If the McDonald's model were applied universally all over the world, it would be an environmental disaster. In America, the average annual consumption of meat is 120 kilograms. That's almost 250 pounds of meat a year. If every human being on this planet ate that quantity of meat, even five planets would not be enough land to produce it all. I have a lot of respect for American culture, but I don't believe that those food habits should be applied all over the world.
Carlo Petrini, a founder of the International Slow Food Movement, what's your idea? Describe for us your idea of a perfect dinner.
In every interview, I'm always asked this question.
Qual è il piatto che ti piace di più?
What is the dish that you love the most? What is the meal, the experience that you like best?
L'ingrediente che mi piace di più è la curiosità.
The ingredient I like most is curiosity.
E in tutte le parti del mondo,
and
I piatti
anywhere I go in the world, the most extraordinary dishes that I find and taste are things that have been created, invented, often by women who sometimes are in even economic difficulty, but they use their ingenuity to produce something extraordinary. Sometimes I'm asked, what is the dish that I identify with, that one identifies most with Carlo Petrini? And since I'm Italian, of course, I have to say it's pasta with tomato sauce. But neither the pasta nor the tomatoes are Italian, because the idea of pasta comes from China, and the tomato comes from America. And yet pasta with tomato sauce is the national Italian dish. So it is exchange which helps this to happen.
Some would call that globalization.
Well, the first great moment of globalization was the discovery of America.
Yeah. So what are you saying? Stop it now?
The idea is when you take a product and you adapt it for another part of the world. Because the tomato was born in America, but now tomatoes are cultivated in Europe. What isn't right is to take tomatoes that are already grown from America and bring them to Europe.
Carlo Petrini, founder of the International Slow Food Movement, interpreted by Erica Lesser, executive director of Slow Foods USA. Thanks to both of you. Thank you very much.
Grazie mille.
Thank you.
And how long do you take to eat your dinner?
Normale.
Like what?
It depends on who I'm at the table with.
5 minutes?
No, 5 minutes. No. 5 minutes.
An hour?
Depende, perché.
It really depends, because sometimes all you need is just one plate. But what's important is that eating is an act that is shared.
Mangiare è un atto che va condiviso.
This is not how I would like to be. This is not the way I want to approach food.
Anche perché.
Also because the first time that we eat, we were not alone. Because the first moment in which we eat, is in taking milk from our mother's breast. And so to eat with others is an act of love. Because when we're born, when we come out of the maternal womb, we don't see.
Non sentivamo.
We don't hear anything.
Ma con questo cercavamo,
but with our mouths, we're able to seek out the breast of our mothers. And this is the first act of love.
Della mamma per il bambino.
Of the mother for the child.
Ma il bambino,
but the child also gives pleasure to the mother. This is the true sense of eating.
Convivialità.
Conviviality.
Italians. Again, Carlo Petrini. And staying with the theme, if you're sick of burgers, tomorrow we'll have a recipe for slow-grilled Greek salad. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today. Will a new policy on SAT scores affect all college students? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What happens when you put men and women together in close quarters with not a lot to do? This isn't some silly reality show. It's real life for 1.4 million Americans living in nursing homes, often dating, falling in love, having sex, sometimes complicated by the fact that while the body is willing, the mind may be failing, which raises questions of informed consent and liability. We're going to have a conversation about elder adults, and it may entail some explicit adult language. Melinda Hennenberger is a writer for Slate.com. She recently wrote about a relationship between two older lovers. Melinda, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
And tell us about Bob and Dorothy. These are the names that you gave them.
Right.
95-year-old man, his 82-year-old girlfriend in a nursing home.
Right.
They were caught in the act. But before, you know, that happened, tell us about the relationship. People saw them getting closer.
Well, these are two older people who both suffer from dementia and who had been falling in love for all to see. They had started taking all their meals together and sitting by each other every day and spending more and more time together and became a couple. The man, whom I'm calling Bob, mm-hmm. would, you know, propose on a daily basis for all to hear, and she had started playing the piano again, and he would sing along. Maybe he didn't know what song she was playing, but he would sing anyway. You know, having seen pictures of them when they were together, I mean, it's really impossible to look at them and not see the 18-year-olds inside there.
It's exactly what you would hope for your parents in a nursing home. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor has shared her story, just the former Supreme Court justice whose husband has Alzheimer's and has a new girlfriend in a nursing home, and the whole family has accepted it. But then there's the moment where it becomes a physical and sexual relationship.
Right.
What happened when that happened?
Right. Well, both families thought the relationship was cute, was the word they put on, one of them put on it, until it became sexual. And the son of the man involved walked in on them in bed one morning and was just completely dumbstruck, horrified, asked that they be kept apart, didn't want them. He walked in on her performing oral sex on him. Not only did he not want to see that, which is a natural reaction, I think. You don't want to think about your parent that way. He just thought that that was completely inappropriate, viewed the woman as the aggressor in the situation, a conclusion he came to because he thought that his dad, suffering from dementia, might not understand what was going on, wasn't really open to having the relationship continue, was fine with them having meals together, maybe a peck on the cheek, but not a sexual relationship.
And before that, there were workers in the nursing home who took sides on the issue. Some had moral concerns about it. But so they are pulled apart.
That's right. In the end, the man's family moved him out of the nursing home. And Dorothy's doctor said she probably would not have survived the loss except that her Alzheimer's was protecting her at that point, because after a matter of weeks, the memory had faded mercifully in that case.
By the way, you met Dorothy. Bob
yes, I
was
did.
Bob was moved to another facility. Do you feel? I mean, they say that Dorothy doesn't remember. You said you felt a sadness around her.
The way she put it was to say, "He came and he left. That's all there is to say." The people who care for her every day say there is a sadness in her now that wasn't there before. She won't take her meals in the dining room anymore because that's where she used to have every meal with Bob. She has stopped playing the piano. Her physical well-being in general has really deteriorated, I'd be very surprised if she didn't carry something of it with her.
What is the law on this? What rights do seniors have in nursing homes, behind closed doors, in their rooms, to have sex?
Federal law does provide a right to privacy. That definitely extends to people in institutions. And law also provides for social, psychosocial well-being, which has been interpreted to mean the sex life. But really, the family controls that. So it's really up to the family.
Is that because of the dementia or Alzheimer's?
Yes, it's because of the dementia. It's because questions are then raised about what's informed consent. So what you really want to do is have talked about this beforehand, have appointed either a sexual guardian or even formalized it with the sexual power of attorney with someone you trust to help sort through what your decision would be.
This is amazing. I mean, this is what Dorothy's daughter, who is a lawyer, said to you. You know, this is something that she's learned from this, that you should draw up a sexual power of attorney before you end up in a nursing home. What an astonishing thought.
Right. You know, we're all going to get old if we're lucky. And if we get lucky when we're old, then we want to be able to have a relationship.
But you also put yourself in the position of the workers in the nursing home. There were points, again,
right.
these are elderly people who, you know, whose thinking was compromised. And there were a couple of occasions where they were having, you know, sexual acts right out in the hall in the lobby. And, you know, how much do you have to protect the other people in the nursing home?
I'm not sure how difficult it is if you have someone on staff who's trained or if you have family members who are willing to figure out, you know, whether they've given consent and what it is their wishes really are. I think it's more these facilities overreacting, worrying about lawsuits. So I think there just has to be an awareness and a willingness to sort through the issues.
Well, we talked about the legal level. And by the way, Dorothy's daughter was sort of threatening lawsuit if the couple was pulled apart. But the son was also making threatening noises about what he thought was aggressive behavior on the part of the woman others saw as a relationship. But what about the medical aspects? I mean, what did doctors say to you about sex and the elderly?
Gerontologists are pretty much in agreement that it's very beneficial, that it not only improves mood but overall physical function, that in this case it had even improved Dorothy's memory. As her doctor said, "I'm sorry, but if you've lived to 95, sex is not going to kill you. It's going to prolong your life." So there's not much disagreement on that score, that the whole idea of, oh, he's going to have a heart attack is overblown. In some instances, people have not been allowed to have conjugal visits with their spouses of 50 years in these cases. It really is something that's not a new issue because older people have always had relationships. But I think as the baby boom generation ages, we're going to be hearing more and more about these cases. Older people who not only came of age after the sexual revolution but have been used to asserting themselves, I think are not going to put up with being treated like children in the nursing home.
That's Melinda Henneberger, a writer for Slate.com, telling us the story of a 95 and an 82-year-old who found love in a nursing home and then were separated because at least one of the children objected. Melinda, thanks so much for talking to us and telling us the story.
Thank you.
Okay, here's a quick heads up on some upcoming stories. 2001 A Space Odyssey turns 40 this year, and the film star, Pierre Delay, says people still ask him to explain that ending. We'll ask him, too. Also, one of the summer's most recommended reads, the story of Edgar Sawtelle, and Ry Cooder, as well, is coming up in the days ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. The College Board, that organization that administers the SAT, is trying to reduce the stress of college applications by changing its SAT score reporting policy. Now, some are applauding this change, which will take effect in February 2009. Others say it will disadvantage less wealthy students. Scott Jasik is a writer for Inside Higher Ed. That's the online education magazine. He joins us. And, Scott, let's start by reminding ourselves, how does the SAT test score reporting work now?
Right now, students can take it however many times they want if they're willing to pay, and a college would receive all of the scores.
And how many students, you know, what percentage of students do take it many times?
About 15% of students take it three times or more. They tend to be the wealthier students because the College Board waives the $45 fee for low-income students, but only for taking the test twice.
So if someone can't afford that $45 fee, they're less likely to take it a third time. But does research show that taking it over and over again improves the test scores?
Well, it depends who you ask. The College Board says no. But the people who are taking it repeatedly aren't just paying the extra $45. They are quite likely also paying much more for coaching services to help them take the test better. And the word on the street is that you can do better by taking coaching classes and then taking the test again.
Huh. Okay, so right now you can take the test many times if you can afford to pay the fee. You have to submit all the scores to the colleges that you're applying to. What is the change that the College Board is going to make?
The change is they're going to let students decide which time they took the test will be reported, and it can be only once. The key is if you were taking the test multiple times, there was in some ways an embarrassment check on you. If you sent too many scores, that said something to the college. Now, that sort of factor disappears.
And now, so what's the debate? Because some people would say, well, you know, some people don't do well with tests. It takes them a while. You know, there's something about a test that doesn't really calculate how well they do. But others are saying, well, wait a second. This means that the kid who can afford to spend $500 on retaking the test, and much more if you throw in the coaching, is going to be weighed equally with the child who can only afford to take one test. So,
right. I mean, there's already a lot of concern that the SAT gives extra advantages to wealthier students. There is historically a very direct correlation between family income and scores on the SAT. So what people are concerned about is what they have just done gives an additional edge to the people who already have an edge.
And just briefly tell us, there's a competing test to the SAT. It's the ACT.
Correct. The ACT generally is seen as more closely matching what goes on in the classroom. So when you hear about, say, a student who, quote, doesn't test well on the SAT, many times they will do relatively better on the ACT.
Well, you write that the ACT is more consumer-friendly. It's got score choice, but no penalty for guessing, an optional essay.
And as a result, the ACT is actually gaining in popularity. Historically, the ACT was dominant in the Midwest, but in New England, nobody took it. Most colleges will, in fact, accept the ACT or the SAT. And one of the trends in recent years is more students taking both tests and then deciding which one presents them best and submitting that score.
Scott, isn't another trend that colleges are dropping tests altogether?
Yes. Generally, that trend is coming up the most at liberal arts colleges, which are making it optional. And so what happens is students take the test. They look at the average that was reported for the college for the previous year. If they're above the average, they report their scores. If they're below the average, they don't report their scores.
Ah, so you still have to take it.
Well, you don't have to take it, but de facto, people are taking it. The other thing that you have right now is, let's say you're applying to just liberal arts colleges, and you've picked five liberal arts colleges in New England that you like. Odds are, right now, at least one of them still requires the SAT. So you're going to go and take the test. If the number of liberal arts colleges grows that are not requiring at all, you might start to see changes in test-taking behavior. But we're not there yet.
Yeah. That's Scott Jasik from the online higher education magazine Inside Higher Ed. Scott, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thanks. Glad to help. Take care.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
You don't know me and I don't know you. So let's cut to the chase. The name is Stu. And I'll be near.
narrating this gig, so just sit tight. We might play all night.
Well, more people know Stu, a.k.a. Mark Stewart, now. He is the co-author and lead performer of the Broadway sensation Passing Strange, the loosely autobiographical story of Stu's travels from Los Angeles to Amsterdam and Berlin, with experiments in sex, drugs, and rock and roll along the way. Passing Strange won the Tony Award for Best Book. It was a nominee for Best Musical, but Stu, frontman for the LA-based indie band The Negro Problem, will tell you that Passing Strange is more like a rock concert, and there's no Tony category yet for that. And Stu joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
You have said that the most terrifying combination of words in the English language is rock musical. Why is that?
Because what people have called a rock musical, at least as long as I've been aware of them, has been something that features music that no self-respecting rock fan would ever listen to, you know. Our goal was to take the music that we actually play with our band in the clubs and just take that actual music and put it on the American musical stage without any watering down or without any compromises.
And I'm blessed to entertain. The crowd laughs and swoons. It's loud guitars and champagne. And I sleep well past noon. But I've got a lot to explain to myself, not to you. Like who lost track of her pain while working their wound.
Let's switch to the autobiographical part, the loosely autobiographical part.
What we call autobiographical fiction.
Ah, yeah. And so were you a black man in L.A., a young black man growing up in L.A.?
That's been confirmed, yes.
Yes.
That has been confirmed. Beyond that, every single thing that happens in this play, I can tell you the actual sort of real-life situation that inspired it, but it didn't necessarily happen exactly the way we presented on the stage.
Huh. Did you reject a conservative Baptist family background?
Absolutely. My family wasn't all that conservative, but I certainly rejected that world that I was asked to buy into, starting with probably 8 or 10 years old, you know, going to church every week, and I knew pretty early on that that was not going to be a part of my world, even though that was the world that my mother would have liked me to, you know, enter into.
Hmm. You know? Well, in fact, let's listen to the Baptist Fashion Show. It's one of the earlier songs in Passing Strange when there's still a young man in Los Angeles rejecting the church. Let's listen.
Mama says you gotta go to the Baptist Fashion Show. Holy war on Sunday morning. It was war on Sunday morning.
Well, from Los Angeles, where it's obviously not working, the young man in Passing Strange, referred to simply as the youth, makes his way to Amsterdam. Now, you're the narrator of the whole performance. As we heard, you introduced yourself as Stu, and you're narrating this. Are you the youth? Who's the youth?
The youth is everybody from me to James Baldwin, Josephine Baker, any person who ever left their home in order to search for something that they thought was more real than where they came from. So it's a composite.
Yeah. The young man leaves Los Angeles and arrives in Amsterdam. Let's listen.
Amsterdam, spring sunshine. Amsterdam, spring sunshine.
Is that how you felt, Stu, when you arrived in Amsterdam from L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, I think I felt like that every time I arrived in, like, any new place. But, yeah, I mean, Amsterdam is sort of like it appears, at least, from that kid's vantage point, you know, kind of like a utopian world, you know. All the things that he was told were vices and sins and all the things that were illegal and done undercover were suddenly being done right out in the open in cafes and in the streets, and that's, for him, that classic sort of line, you know, like, everything I know is wrong. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Everything they told me I couldn't do, everything they told me that was wrong to do, everyone here is doing it. And, like, not killing each other.
It's your first time.
Does it show? I'm like an ice cube gone to melt.
I hope you find yourself at home.
I like the cards that I've been dealt.
And how's your mind?
Oh, it's blown. It's a vibe I've never felt.
Welcome to Amsterdam.
But the euphoria doesn't last.
No, I think that's the nature of euphoria, isn't it?
Yeah. You can have too much of that
fleeting.
Good thing. Right. I want to ask you, before we move on to Berlin, all the voices we're hearing in the cast are black actors. They play black and white characters, straight and gay characters, American, European. Was that a casting decision, or did it just happen that way?
We started out with just interracial casting because we wanted to see how that would work, and that didn't work. And then all of us at the same time looked at each other and said, let's just make it like The Wizard of Oz. Let's just make it, you know, the people he grows up with initially, who are black people, let's just have those people follow him around all the time. And then, of course, the sort of, you know, devil-may-care kind of approach to casting ended up, of course, like all these kind of mistakes and accidents, it ended up having meaning, because the whole play is about masks and adopting masks and picking them up and dropping them, and what is authentic and what isn't. And so actually having black characters play white people actually ended up being like a central aspect of the play, even though it definitely wasn't written that way.
Well, in fact, let's listen to a song that touches on the issue of race. It's called The Black One. Let's listen.
Who lends the club that speakeasy air? The black one, the black one. Who dances like a god and has wunderbar hair? Der Schwarze.
Is this something, Stu, that you felt as a black from Los Angeles in Berlin?
Oh, well, there's no question. I went to Berlin with two other black guys and a couple of Jewish guys. And, yeah, we were objectified all over the place, you know. Sometimes in a good way, you know, and sometimes in a bad way, you know. But, you know, ultimately, yeah, it was something, you know, to go from just being just another guy on the street to suddenly being, like, you know, romanticized and glorified and objectified because of your skin color was quite a interesting thing.
He's doing the same thing.
Except I call the surface me.
He's dancing in a cage.
But I'm the one with the key.
And he's the black one.
All of us are just constantly, you know, whether we admit it or not, we're always thinking about the demographic of whatever room we're sitting in, you know, or whatever party, or people always ask us, oh, is your audience diverse? How's your audience at Broadway? Well, what do you mean, how's the audience? And what everyone really means is, you know, well, how many black people show up? You know what I mean?
How do you feel about, though, that you might be, I mean, talk about the great white hope on the great white way. Do you find more minorities and young people? Do
Yes, coming? We do. Yeah. Absolutely do, yes. From what I've been told, because I don't go to Broadway shows, so I really don't know who goes to Broadway shows, but they tell me that our crowd is alarmingly diverse, and not just black people, but like lots of different people of color and younger people, obviously, who have heard that we actually have actual music.
I gotta fill the void with music. I'll fill the void with song till my cup runneth over.
We're such a different thing. I don't mean like bragging. I mean like we just are a different thing, and it's almost insane to even compare Passing Strange. I feel like there might be other shows like Passing Strange sometime soon, because now that we've done it, of course, other people are going to try to do it. But whatever, you know, anything new is interesting and fun, and God knows Broadway needs newness.
We've been speaking with Stu. He's co-creator of the Broadway hit Passing Strange. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stu, thank you so much.
Anytime.
I'll grow older and keep filling my cup. I'll grow colder, I'll grow bolder, I'll grow older, but I'll never grow up. And this is not a passing phase.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.
Starting to feel